There are a lot of true crime podcasts out there, and I have 30 seconds to convince you why you should check out Crime Lines. Crime Lines is one of those shows that just lays it all out there. The backstory, the legal context, and details of cases you haven't heard before. If you hear about a true crime case and want to know what happened and why, you're my kind of listener. You can check out Crime Lines wherever you get your podcasts. That's Crime Lines, one word, and get ready to dive deep.
This is Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. I'm Steve Taylor, your host to a horror anthology podcast with carefully curated original tales of terror each week. Our deepest rooted fears are brought to the forefront by a diverse cast of voice talent and masterfully eerie sound design. Make sure to check out Chilling Tales for Dark Nights wherever you get your podcasts. To subscribe now to always be the first to enjoy the horror show.
This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Joseph Scott Hatley? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Joseph Scott Hatley was born on December 20, 1965, and raised in Stephenville, Texas. This town is about 80 miles southeast of Fort Worth. Joseph would later claim that his mother mistreated him, although she denied that accusation. He grew up in a family that frequently discussed religion and took it seriously, but they never talked about sex. Joseph said that when he was young, he suffered from a burning anger that he could not explain. Both he and his sister were overweight, which resulted in them being bullied by local kids. After hearing his sister cry one night after being teased, he fantasized about getting revenge on the perpetrators. Over time, Joseph's anger became more intense as his fantasies grew darker. He became obsessed with serial killers, fixated on adults-only magazines, and fantasized about killing everyone in his school. Joseph eventually transformed into a bully. He became self-centered, arrogant, grandiose, condescending, and thought that he was more intelligent than everyone around him. He did not get along well with other students in school, and he did not date. Joseph had a particularly intense anger due to his failure to find a girlfriend. He described himself as a, quote, fat, antisocial kid, unquote. The first time he consumed alcohol, Joseph knew that he could never give it up. His alcohol use would plague him for the rest of his life. In 1984, Joseph joined the Air Force Reserve. He was sent to Colorado to attend a technical school. There he met a woman, and they became romantically involved. Romance was new to Joseph. He had never even kissed a woman before this. The couple soon married. Joseph's wife enlisted in the Air Force after the training was complete, but Joseph dropped out. She was sent to Guam, where the couple lived together in an apartment. Joseph found work selling insurance. It didn't take long for the couple to start fighting. Their relationship fell apart. Joseph decided to give prayer a chance, but then went in the other direction and asked the devil for help. Joseph was disappointed with the outcome. Secretly seeking support from Satan showed no success. With his marriage disintegrated, 21-year-old Joseph returned to Stephenville, Texas. He worked for his father and continued to drink. Joseph had a small circle of friends who started hanging out with a 30-year-old woman named Susan Woods. He knew who Susan was. She had also been raised in Stephenville. Susan was married to a man named Michael Woods, but the couple was in the process of getting divorced. Michael lived in Indianapolis, Indiana. Joseph would later claim that he believed Susan was flirting with him. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On Sunday, July 26, 1987, Joseph stopped by the house that Susan rented on McNeil Street. They smoked cigarettes and listened to music. According to Joseph's account, he made a romantic advance and Susan slapped him. He blacked out in a rage and committed an assault of a sexual nature against Susan. She told him that she would not tell anyone what happened if he just let her go. Joseph decided to murder her instead. He left her body slumped over a bathtub full of water. On July 28, 1987, 2 days after the murder, Susan's supervisor called her father and said that she missed work for 2 days. Her father went to Susan's house and discovered her body. He contacted the police. Here's what they uncovered during their investigation. The medical examiner believed that Susan died from asphyxiation or drowning. There was no sign of forced entry into Susan's house. No one in the neighborhood had seen anything out of the ordinary. In the living room, there was an ashtray containing 6 cigarette butts. There were fingerprints and palm prints all over the crime scene, but they could not be identified. The police did not know who the perpetrator was, but pretty much everyone in the town believed that Susan's estranged husband, Michael Woods, was the killer. Again, the real killer was Joseph Scott Hatley. Everyone was incorrect. The police in Indianapolis, where Michael Woods lived, interviewed Michael at a police station. He was not aware that Susan had been murdered. He found out after the police accused him of killing Susan and told him that they would put him in a mental hospital if he would just confess. Michael denied any involvement, asked for an attorney, and departed the police station. He claimed that the police harassed him after this. The police did not have Michael's fingerprints, so they arrested him for taking crystal figurines from Susan. The case was dropped, but now they had his fingerprints. The police were excited because they believed they were about to make an arrest, but then realized that Michael's fingerprints did not match those found at the crime scene. For the time being, the case was at a standstill. The police had no leads. After the murder, Joseph went on with his life. He went to Susan's funeral and even signed the guest book. He thought the police would interview him and eventually arrest him, but they never even contacted him. For a little while, Joseph had been maintaining a casual sexual relationship with a teenager named Shannon. In 1988, he committed an assault of a sexual nature against her. Shannon was 16 years old at the time. She was injured in the attack, but managed to survive by convincing Joseph that she loved him and would not tell anybody about his crime. As soon as Shannon escaped, she went to a hospital and contacted the police. Joseph was worried about getting arrested, so he fled Stephenville and ended up in Nevada. He was arrested after committing a robbery there. Joseph was convicted of 2 counts of armed robbery and sentenced to 120 days in a youth offender program. Upon his return to Stephenville, he found out that the grand jury had declined to indict him for attacking Shannon. Despite having escaped responsibility for 2 serious crimes, Susan's murder in 1987 and the attack on Shannon in 1988, Joseph was pretty sure the police were going to arrest him eventually for at least one of those crimes. He moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and became a truck driver. Joseph married in 1993 and went on to have 2 children. After causing a collision at work, he was fired and found a job in a warehouse. Joseph continued to drink excessively. In the late 1990s, he was promoted at work and assigned to a warehouse in Round Rock, Texas. This is about 2.5 hours south of Stephenville. Joseph didn't like being this close to where he had committed 2 crimes, but he really wanted the job. The police had another opportunity to solve Susan's murder after the technology became available to test the DNA on the cigarettes recovered from her house. The results indicated that the DNA belonged to a male, but the identity of the male was not known. In 2005, Michael Woods agreed to provide the police a sample of his DNA. It did not match the cigarette butts. It was only at this time that Michael was told he was no longer a suspect in Susan's murder. In 2006, investigators gained access to another technological advancement, the FBI's electronic fingerprint database. This is when they discovered the fingerprints found at the crime scene belonged to Joseph Scott Hatley. The police confronted Joseph on June 6, 2006. The irony of the date, 6606, was not lost on investigators. Joseph was arrested the next day after his wife filed charges related to domestic violence. He was charged in connection with Susan's murder a few days later. The DNA from the cigarettes was matched to Joseph. The police were now certain of his guilt. Joseph pleaded guilty to murder and received a 30-year prison sentence. He was released after only 11 years. He lived alone in a trailer in Abilene, Texas. On October 31, 2021, Joseph told his daughter that bladder cancer he had been diagnosed with in 2017 had returned and was in his spine. On December 9, 2021, Joseph's landlord found him dead on the floor of his trailer. Joseph Scott Hatley was 55 years old.
In January of 2008, real estate agent Lindsay Buziak received a call from a woman who said that she and her husband were urgently seeking a home with a budget of $1 million. Eager for the commission a deal like this would bring, Lindsay found the perfect home and set up a showing. Just 1 hour after the showing, Buziak's colleagues found her lying in a pool of blood in the master bedroom with multiple stab wounds. To this day, the case remains unsolved. I'm Savannah Breimer, host of the true crime podcast Killer Instinct, the research-backed show that covers cases like Lindsay's and aims to bring justice to the families of victims of horrific crimes. Each month, I explore a new sector of true crime, from serial killers to stalkers to female killers. For each case, I break down the moments leading up to the crime, debunk past theories, and share the experiences of those affected by these tragedies. Join me every Wednesday as I unveil the truth behind some of the darkest cases in history. Listen and subscribe to Killer Instinct wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Stacy.
And we make Trashy Divorces, everybody's favorite good podcast about bad relationships.
Looking for something true crimey without the gore or the body count?
We've been churning out funny, feisty, feminist episodes since 2019. So if you're looking to put some scandalous stories told well into your ears this summer, check out Trashy Divorces, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Trust us, we've covered someone you love.
Or someone you love to hate.
Now moving to my analysis. As I mentioned, Susan's estranged husband, Michael Woods, was treated like a suspect for many years. At the time of the murder, which of course occurred in Stephenville, Texas, several witnesses had seen Michael in Indianapolis, Indiana. Michael did not trust the police enough to tell them about the witnesses. He was afraid they would try to undermine the witness accounts, like the police would approach the witnesses and try to disassemble their stories. Investigators believe that Michael could have been responsible for the murder until discovering his fingerprints did not match. Even then, some officers were not convinced of his innocence. He wasn't completely cleared until his DNA was tested. Why were the police so suspicious of Michael? What was it about him that made everyone so angry? Michael had an interesting history that did not help his image. For a while when he was young, he was kind of a wandering musician, basically just roaming around the East Coast. One day, a friend asked him to drive a truck to Stephenville, Texas, for a move. After Michael arrived, he stayed in the town. Michael met Susan at a convenience store, and they became romantically involved. She thought that he looked a lot like Bob Seger, but Susan's friends were not impressed with his night moves. They felt as though Susan was running against the wind in that relationship. Susan had not dated in high school and did not attend her prom. She did not possess advanced partner selection skills. In 1985, the couple rented the house on McNeil Street, where Susan would later be murdered. Michael made a bad impression on people in the Stephenville community. This was a very conservative town, and Michael didn't fit in for a number of reasons. He mostly just stayed around his house and often failed to wear a shirt. He rode a motorcycle, his hair was long, he struggled to maintain steady employment, and he would get into physical altercations. Michael was described as having a bad attitude and being immature. He never went to football games, rodeos, or attended church services, all of which were popular activities in Stephenville. Michael attracted the attention of the police. They assumed that he was up to no good. When Michael separated from Susan in February 1987, he left behind an audio cassette containing a 30-minute recording. He mostly talked about how terrible Susan was and how the failure of their marriage was entirely her fault. As if this wasn't bad enough, Michael also deposited handwritten notes all over the house, reinforcing the same message. Susan found them for weeks after he left. Out of concern for Susan's safety, a friend of hers nailed all the windows shut in the house and let her borrow a pistol. It's easy to appreciate why the police suspected Michael of being involved, but there's no excuse for their failure to consider Joseph as a potential suspect. Joseph said that even a basic investigation would have identified him as the killer in only a few days. The police never interviewed him. It seems as though the police had tunnel vision and were focused entirely on Michael. This put Michael in a terrible position. He was constantly worried for years about being arrested. At one point, he was sued by Susan's family. He didn't show up to the trial, probably because it was in Texas. He lost an $11,000 life insurance benefit that was due to him. In addition, the judge ordered him to pay $700,000. Fortunately for Michael, he was able to avoid paying it by staying out of Texas. Michael became paranoid and was treated by a psychotherapist. He was pretty sure that he was going to be in prison someday. Michael even started exercising so he could better defend himself in prison. He only found a measure of peace when the DNA testing excluded him as a suspect. Now let's take a look at Susan's situation. Susan was at a vulnerable point in her life when she came in contact with Joseph. She was inexperienced romantically, and her only long-term relationship had just ended in a painful way. Susan was having difficulty navigating the world of dating. She had at least one bad experience before meeting Joseph, when a potential romantic partner became too aggressive. Susan spent a lot of time working at a sandpaper factory, which, not surprisingly, was really wearing her down. She was working extra hours to replace the vehicle that Michael had taken when he moved out. Susan was lonely and probably spent time with Joseph simply to have company. Now moving to Joseph, the last major figure in the story. Joseph wrote extensively about his crimes. He believed that he had made a deal with Satan, and everything that went wrong in his life was punishment from God. In reality, it's more likely that Joseph was psychopathic and narcissistic. He was sadistic, vindictive, impulsive, irresponsible, manipulative, cold, callous, had a sense of entitlement, and consumed excessive quantities of alcohol. He was excited by dominating women, just like these serial killers with whom he was fascinated. Even after getting away with murder, he committed another serious offense. Joseph complained about how badly his life went, but he actually escaped responsibility at every turn. He was even able to avoid serving 19 years of his 30-year prison sentence. Now moving to my final thoughts. If one partner in a toxic romantic relationship is murdered, the other partner is always going to be a suspect. I think the lesson learned in this case is how investigators need to look at all possibilities when trying to solve a homicide. In this case, investigators became fixated on an estranged husband who lived 1,000 miles away, instead of a psychopathic killer who attended the murder victim's funeral.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.